Today at Reader's Corner, Mike Brown, author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming.
All of this debate about Pluto and finally demoting Pluto came down to a definition of the word planet. We don't use definitions in astronomy. We use concepts. Astronomers have found nearly 2,000 objects beyond Neptune in this belt called the Kuiper Belt. And amongst those objects, Eris, the one that I found, is even more massive than Pluto. Anytime people ask me about why Pluto's no longer a planet or what's going on here, I get to stop and talk to them about the science of these discoveries of the past few years. That's just as good as it gets for me.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Many of us can probably recall maps of the solar system from our school days that showed 9 planets, from Mercury to Pluto, orbiting around the sun. All that changed in 2006 when the International Astronomical Association voted to demote Pluto from a real planet to the newly coined category of dwarf planet, a move that stirred controversy around the world. Astronomer Mike Brown played a key role in the decision to boot Pluto from the pantheon of planets. His discovery of a possible 10th planet, nicknamed Xena after the warrior princess on TV, raised questions about the definition of planet and whether Pluto and other discoveries belong. Dr. Brown has written about his experience in his book, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming, and today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview. Dr. Brown is the Richard and Barbara Rosenberg Professor of Planetary Astronomy at the California Institute of Technology and has been on the faculty there since 1996. He specializes in the discovery and study of bodies at the edge of the solar system. In 2006, he was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. Dr. Brown joins us by phone for this interview. Mike Brown, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So, Mike, how did you study to become a planetary astronomer? What degrees did you earn over the course of your school days, so to speak, that put you in this seat at Cal Poly, or Caltech, excuse me?
Caltech, yeah. So it was the original degree, my undergraduate degree, was in physics, although I knew from as long as I can remember, I knew that what I really wanted to do was do astronomy. But I thought, as an undergraduate, I thought you can't major in astronomy. No one can get an actual job in astronomy, so you have to get something more respectable like physics. And then by the time I finished physics, I still just really wanted to be an astronomer, and so I took the leap and got my PhD in astronomy at UC Berkeley, and still not convinced that you can actually get a job as an astronomer. But I finished there, and then very shortly thereafter started here, and I've been doing it ever since.
One of the things that I found fascinating about your book, and we're certainly going to spend most of the time talking about Pluto, but in setting it up, what was amazing to me was what I guess I would call either planetary politics, or I think you referred to it as solar system politics in the book. The International Astronomical Union is this collection of folks like you who make these decisions. And I wonder if you could walk us through just what is that union, who belongs, how tough is it to get in, how often do they meet, and what do they decide?
So the International Astronomical Union, the IAU, I'll say for short, it's the International Professional Group of Astronomers. Union is just the old-fashioned word. It's not a union in any union sense.
Sure.
And it's just the International Gathering of Astronomers that happens every 3 years to talk about the latest astronomical discoveries, and it is also the body that has been, the IAU has responsibility for things like making sure that all countries use the same clock. And when we have those leap seconds every once in a while, these are the guys who decide that there's going to be a leap second and everybody agrees that there's a leap second. And so there are all these minute details that are actually quite important to the world that are astronomical that the IAU really takes care of, that most people never care about and never hear about. So only on rare occasions, and by rare I mean this is the only one I can even think of, has the IAU ever done anything that anyone has actually noticed. And this is the one that it came to them to decide exactly what to do with Pluto and with the definition of a planet, because it was clearly up in the air and nobody quite knew what to do after the discoveries in 2005. And so they are the group who who finally had to make a decision.
When you said that the IAU was charged to do this or that, is that did they charge themselves, or is this a United Nations charge to the?
It actually predates the UN. Believe it or not. But it is by international treaty that it was decided that that for things astronomical that the IAU would do it, and so it's international treaty to codify things in the sky, to give names to things in the sky, so everybody has, you know, it would be hard if astronomers in different countries use different names for everything in the sky. So there's a standard system of naming names for things like planets, for things like asteroids, for all the stars, and then time. A lot of it has to do with time, and a lot of its push to do astronomy has been to make sure that we have accurate time.
And recently, just a few months ago, we had an asteroid come closer to Earth than a good number of people in your profession would have liked, I guess. Or maybe you would have. Maybe
No, you
did like it. Of course you did. You got to see it. But anyway, did that spur the International Astronomical Union into any kind of special action?
There has already been, for more than a decade now, a pretty big international push to track, to map and track asteroids, particularly the asteroids of the type that might be big enough to do some damage. So the one that hit in Siberia was pretty small, and it was bad luck that people actually were in its path. And so usually those sorts of things hit moderately frequently and nothing happens. But slightly bigger ones could hit and do some pretty big damage. And so the astronomers have been trying very hard to find all of them to make sure they're not going to hit. And if they are, which so far none of them have a chance, but if you ever found one that was going to hit, we would like to try to figure out ways to deflect these things. So this has been spurred by international governments, not as much by the IAU. The IAU is more likely to react if somebody pushes the idea that we should find these things. But to find these things and deflect them is a hugely expensive undertaking, and so this is a government-level task to think about.
One more question on that, and then I promise our listeners will get on with your book. But is there really, really any entity today that is ready to deal with this issue of another asteroid coming close to Earth? I mean, you hear all these, maybe it's all science fiction, but you hear these cases of what happens if one comes and would actually hit and do what it did to the dinosaurs a long time ago.
Let me say first that it will happen. We will get impacts of the size that wiped out the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
But the dinosaurs got wiped out 65 million years ago, and so you know that the frequency that those things hit is pretty small. So, you know, probably you can wait another 65 million years and it's gonna happen again, and maybe by then we'll know how to deflect those big ones.
All right. Well, I'll be older then anyway. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the meantime, absolutely, astronomers have found most of the asteroids that are big enough to hurt us, and the good news is that none of them has got our name on it currently. And so the smaller ones, we're now starting to track down the smaller ones, which wouldn't cause like a dinosaur extinction event, but would instead, you know, if it happened to hit New York City, it could wipe out an entire city.
Sure, sure.
So we've been now starting to track those down. So far, nothing that's that has any danger whatsoever. But those the size that we now at least have some ideas about how you would actually deflect them. The nice thing is you would find them 30, 40, 50 years ahead of time, not a day ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you have a lot of time to deal with how to deflect. So I'm actually, even though it makes for good science fiction movies, I'm not worried about this at all. There are many scarier things going on the Earth than asteroids coming from the sky that are going to hit us, I think.
Well, now that we're talking about asteroids, that gets us to the definitional problem. Well, what is the scientific criteria for planethood today?
See, now I'm not going to answer that question for you.
Oh.
that is, you started out with the one question that I will not answer, and the reason I won't answer it is actually important.
Uh-huh.
So all of this debate about Pluto and finally demoting Pluto came down to exactly what you're asking, came down to a definition of the word planet. And there is now, you can look it up, there's a very lawyer-like definition, three-part lawyer-like definition of the word planet. And the problem is, whenever you write down a three-part lawyer-like definition, you get lawyers involved. And that's exactly what happened. People started nitpicking the definition and saying, well, but, you know, Neptune doesn't fit because this, and Earth doesn't fit because this, which is silly. And the reason it's silly is because the definition was an attempt, and a poor one, I think, but it was an attempt to write down a concept. And in astronomy, we don't use definitions in astronomy. We use concepts. Everybody understands, everybody who does astronomy understands the concept of what is a star and what is a galaxy. And there's no need to have a written definition with check boxes. Are you a star if check, check, check? Everybody knows what they are. And in the solar system, everybody understands the concept of what a planet is these days. So I'll tell you the concept rather than tell you the definition.
Okay.
The concept is, if you look in the solar system, you see these eight really large objects. They're in nearly circular orbits in one disk around the sun. They're very regular. If you just looked at them without knowing what they were, they would immediately stand out as something special. They're this big and regular and in one area. And then within the planets, beyond the planets, between the planets, sometimes hitting the planets, there are billions of these tiny little flecks moving in and out and being scattered around by the planets and stirred up everywhere. And they are clearly very different from the planets. They're not on circular orbits. They're not in one plane. They're tiny. They're kicked around by the planets. And that division between this very regular set of large objects and this very irregular set of objects that are just flitting in and out in between, it's such a clear division. That is where you draw the line at planet, even though writing down a lawyer-like definition is a little bit hard because you get lawyers involved.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, Pluto, you think today, belongs in the latter category and not the former category.
So it's not just I think. I mean, even for the people who back 5 or 6 years ago wanted to defend Pluto's status, they couldn't argue with the fact that Pluto belongs to that group of tiny objects that flit between the planets. And that's really the main characteristic of Pluto and of all these other objects that I discovered and of all the asteroids and everything else. They're on crossing orbits. They cross the orbits of planets. They get tossed around by the planets, and the planets are these big, stately things going around in these beautiful circular orbits.
You're listening to Mike Brown. He is a professor of planetary astronomy at Caltech, and he's written a book called How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming, and that's what we're talking about. So, Mike, in 1992, there was the discovery of an asteroid belt called the Kuiper Belt. Would you explain what role that played in getting you and your colleagues to where we are today in the demotion of Pluto?
Oh, it was the key moment. So in 1992, a pair of astronomers, Dave Jewett and Jane Liu, discovered the first new object beyond Neptune. Pluto was known to be beyond Neptune, but Pluto at the time was thought to be this lonely oddball out at the edge of the solar system. 1992, Jewett and Liu found a second lonely oddball, so Pluto had a little bit of company, but finding that second one made it very clear that there were a ton of them out there. And so over the course of now more than 20 years, astronomers exploring that region have found nearly 2,000 objects out beyond Neptune in this belt called the Kuiper Belt. And amongst those objects, there are objects that are nearly the size of Pluto, and even one, Eris, the one that I found, which is even more massive than Pluto. So it was clear once the objects beyond Neptune started being discovered where Pluto belonged. Pluto had always just sort of not really made sense before, and now suddenly, you look at all these other objects, and Pluto has a family. This is the part of the solar system to which Pluto really belongs, not really to the planets. And that was the argument that really led to the demotion of Pluto. And it was partially just in general it made sense. The other major issue was the discovery of Eris, the one that was originally nicknamed Xena, now official name is Eris. Eris is more massive than Pluto. And so when it was discovered, it was clear that either it had to be a planet, or Pluto had to not be a planet. You couldn't have both. And that meant that there's something major had to change. And when faced with needing to change something major, astronomers stepped back and made the very wise decision that really we now knew that it was a mistake to have called Pluto a planet back in 1930, and let's not compound that mistake by calling something else a planet. That doesn't make sense either. So now we have stepped back and actually set everything right, because we found these things that are bigger and the same size as Pluto.
In order to search and discover the skies, you have to have the right telescope to do it. And I know there's probably a lot of amateurs listening in who have their own approach to this, but you, on the other hand, use the Palomar 200-inch Hale telescope and the 48-inch Schmidt. I don't know even what that means, and I'd love if you could to describe for us just how very different that is for the amateurs out there who are using something that is much smaller and less expensive, I'm sure. What do these things look like? And you had a great description in your book of what it even took you as a young professor to get scheduled to use these things. I mean, these things are booked every day of the year, and you ended up getting, I don't know what it was, Thanksgiving, Christmas, or whatever. But walk us through what that's like and what kind of investment that must be.
It is true. As a young astronomer, when you're applying to get time on the telescope, you tend to get those Thanksgiving nights and those Christmas nights that the older astronomers would rather not have.
Right.
And now I don't get them, and I give them to the younger astronomers.
Exactly.
It is true. So they are beautiful machines. The ones at Palomar in particular are essentially Depression-era mechanical engineering. I mean, it looks that the 200-inch telescope at Palomar looks like the inside of a sleek, incredibly clean battleship. It's just a massive construction, and when the dome opens up to the sky, this many, many ton telescope slides into place almost noiselessly. It's just an incredible machine. The 48-inch telescope is a much smaller telescope than the big one at Palomar, and it was built in a way that you never hear of these days. It was built because they had money left over when they finished the 200-inch, and it cost less than they thought it was going to. So they built a little sidekick next to it, and the sidekick was designed to cover wide swaths of sky all at once so that the big telescope would know where to look. And this telescope had been covering wide swaths of sky for many, many years, but it had been doing so using the old technique of using photographic plates. Photographic plate is just a big piece of glass that you paint photographic emulsion on, and you slap it to the back of the telescope, and you expose it to the sky for half an hour or an hour or something, and then develop it and see what you get. And that's the way astronomy used to work, but these days we now have all these fantastic digital cameras, just like your digital cameras that you have, and we finally got enough digital cameras together that we could make it almost as big as one of these big photographic plates, and we wired them together and put them on the back of this 48-inch telescope and could finally use a pretty big telescope and cover pretty big swaths of the sky at once. And this is what led us to finally find these things. It was that marrying of the old telescope with the new technology that really opened the skies up.
Does the public ever get in to see this? Or I wouldn't expect that they would be able to use them, but can they? You take tours of people through
they
these things?
Absolutely can. So the telescopes are research facilities that are used, as you said, every single night. So they don't get to use them. But the 200-inch telescope has a visitors gallery, and in the daytime, if you're ever around there, it's just outside of San Diego, up in the mountains east of San Diego, and it's spectacular. It's like a cathedral. You walk into the visitors gallery, and you can see the telescope there and see the astronomers working on it in the afternoon. If anybody's ever around there, I highly encourage you to go see, because I think it's just one of the cathedrals of science that we have in the world that's mm-hmm. worth seeing.
You know, the other thing I found fascinating about your book was the naming of these planets and asteroids and the Kuiper Belt, for example. But getting back to the planets, could you explain to our listeners just what and how the IAU goes about naming? I mean, there's a system of classification that you have a lot of fun with in the book, by the way, and it's you got a great read there, because it is fun listening to you, reading you take on these classifications and the names, but it's a pretty big deal in your line of work.
What I found as we continued to find things in the outer solar system, the public is much more engaged with an object that has a name and a story that goes along with that name than they are with an object that has basically a license plate, which is so one of the objects we found is called Sedna. Sedna is the coldest object that we know of in the solar system, and so when we found it, we wanted to give it a name that sort of reflected the cold nature of it. And mythologically, Sedna is an Inuit goddess of the sea, and she lives in an ice cave underneath the Arctic Ocean, and that seemed awfully cool to us, so we went with that as the name. And then when we announced the object, it meant something to people. I got hand-drawn, you know, crayon pictures of Sedna from kids. I got email from astrologers. Astrologers love things with names, apparently. Many different people were excited by the name Sedna when they had not been by the original announcement of the object as 2003 VB12, which is its official license plate number first. And so we quickly realized that getting these things names was a very important deal. And we spend too much time trying to come up with really good names for these things, because each object out there has a little bit of a story that goes along with it. And we have always looked for mythological names that somehow reflect that part of the story so they somehow make sense.
You're listening to Mike Brown. He's written a book called How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Okay, I wouldn't ask you this question, Mike, if I didn't know you didn't have a good sense of humor. But your book is very witty. It's funny. I really enjoyed reading it. But you mentioned astrologer. Are you ever mistaken for an astrologer? Does anybody ever come up to you?
All the time. Astronomers, people, if they're not thinking very hard, will often ask you, oh, so you're an astrologer? I'm like, well, no, I'm not. You know, astronomers have a love-hate relationship with astrologers, but usually it's just the hate part of it. I am tolerant of astrologers of the sort who actually know their sky. You know, I always think of astronomy and astrology as sisters that split a couple hundred years ago, and astronomy went the scientific route and astrology went the more mythological route. And there are people who call themselves astrologers out there who know an awful lot about the sky and think an awful lot about it and love the sky. And this is not, you know, your newspaper horoscope kind of people. Those are just kind of silly. But there are people, I don't think there's anything to being able to say that it is controlling your life. But I think it's part of our literary heritage and this feeling that we're connected with the universe. And I have a hard time thinking there's something wrong with that.
And you took a lot of grief on this one. I mean, I really don't quite understand where the opposition comes from, what kind of people there are that would get so upset with you that you would receive hate mail?
It's true. I think people have a hard time when they think back to learning about planets in their childhood and they remember Pluto. People have had this soft spot in their heart for Pluto. It's an oddball. It's small. And as funny as this sounds, I think that the Disney dog made a big difference in people's feelings towards Pluto. And so they have a hard time making it go away.
Who would have thunk? Now, there's something that never really occurred to me while I was reading your book, that Pluto the dog might have had something to do with all this animosity that's been built up. As a science and an educator, why is this classification so important? I mean, what difference does it make?
I think it is critically important, both scientifically and both educationally. The reason is because as a scientist, the first thing you do when you're confronted with a new phenomenon, the first thing you do to try to understand it is to classify. And this is basic classification. And so you look at the solar system and you say, which objects go together, which objects don't go together, and why? And so you realize that these big eight objects are very different than all these other objects that are flitting around. And that tells you the very first, most profound question you would like to understand about the solar system, which is, why is it like that? Why do we have these eight big things and then everything else flitting around? And that question is one that astronomers have been trying to answer about the solar system for the last 30 or 40 years. That gets at one of our most basic research questions, is understanding how the solar system put itself together. So that's scientifically, I think it's critical to get that classification right. And then educationally, the fact that we now have a planetary classification that makes scientific sense instead of this sort of arbitrary one where, you know, Pluto was a planet because we accidentally called it one in 1930, and so planet didn't really mean anything. We now have a meaningful planetary classification. And when we describe the solar system to people, we're describing something physically meaningful, and we can actually teach people the science of the solar system by telling them what planets are and what planets are not, instead of just saying, oh, it's just this historical accident. And so I am quite excited these days that anytime people ask me about why Pluto's no longer a planet, or, you know, what's going on here, is that I get to stop and talk to them about the science of these discoveries of the past few years. And that's just as good as it gets for me.
There was a bit of intrigue in your book that certainly surprised me. It looks like not all planetary astronomers play nice. And at first you thought maybe you were going to defer to these Spanish astronomers for their discovery. But then later you wondered if maybe, in fact, they had fibbed a bit. Tell us about what you discovered and just what was going on there with the Spanish astronomers.
Yeah, it was a crazy set of circumstances. But one of the interesting things that happens when we make these discoveries of these objects in the outer solar system, we then race to figure out everything we can about them before publishing the scientific details of our discovery. And we are racing because we know that it's entirely possible that somebody else is going to discover the same thing and be racing to announce the discovery first, too. And by tradition in science, and I think by good tradition, whoever announces it first is the discoverer. So even if I found it a year ago, if you find it today and you announce it, you are the discoverer because I didn't get around to announcing it. And that's good because it pushes me to go fast, but also to be complete. And so this happened to us. We had discovered one of the big objects out there, and I woke up one morning and got an email saying that somebody else had just discovered this object. And then people wanted to know what we were going to do. Were we going to complain that we had discovered it first? And the answer is no. If they announce it first, they are the discoverers. That's, I think, the right tradition. And then it turned out, as we found out over the ensuing weeks and months, it turned out that I still don't know exactly what happened, but it looks like they never actually discovered the object, that they, in fact, discovered that we had discovered it and then used our discovery to claim that they had discovered it, which is pretty shocking, actually. You don't really expect that sort of thing to happen in science. And so even though the evidence was pretty clear for a long time, I was the one who was most vigorously defending them and saying that's ridiculous, no one would ever do that. But the evidence became pretty overwhelming, so it looks like that really did happen, which is still surprises me.
So how has this drama of over Pluto's demotion impacted your teaching at Caltech and the way you collaborate with your colleagues? Has this elevated you in your career and in your profession substantially?
Well, you know, it's a funny question. It's always a mixed blessing in science to do something that gets publicity. Scientists are always a little bit irritated by other scientists getting publicity for sort of non-scientific things. And the whole Pluto demotion was less about science than about culture, I would say, in many ways. Writing books is often considered not a good thing for scientists to do, too, writing popular-level books. So it's mixed. I think it's an important thing to do. I think that it has been important to help with public engagement. And luckily, I do enough other science that my scientific colleagues are still happy with the actual science that I do. But still, I suspect grumble a little bit about, you know, books and Pluto and all the rest of that stuff.
Well, you have a distinguished vita, and there's no question that you are clearly a professor of planetary astronomy and a great author in addition. I mean, this book, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming, was really a fun read. And Mike, I want to thank you for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Oh, it was quite my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Mike Brown. Next week, Peter Carlson, author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.